Hello and welcome to episode 49 of the Creighton Crowbar PC Gaming Podcast, PC Gaming's answer to Gardner's Question Time. I'm Marsh Davis, or should that be Alan Titch Marsh Davis?
Hey!
I'm joined by three delicate flowers, old fruits, and borderline vegetables of the video gaming industry, Chris Thurston.
Hi.
Tom Francis.
Hello.
And very special guest and prolific lovemaker, and also the maker of the video game Love, Eskil Steenberg.
Thank you very much.
You've got a new game, Eskil.
We've been playing it.
What is it?
It's called Exo, and it's a real-time strategy, stealth, bullet hell game, maybe? I don't know.
I wouldn't have called it bullet hell from what I played. Unless it gets more hectic later on.
That's just because you chose to build only melee units. That's your fault.
I hadn't thought about that. That is one of the unusual things about it. Do you want to explain roughly what it is?
So the backstory of the game is that it's a game that takes place on a planet that for some reason has stopped turning. So one side is always towards the sun, and one is always away from the sun. And the people who live on the sunny side, they burn to a crisp, and everyone on the dark side have frozen to death. And the few people who lived on the sort of twilight land are the survivors. And the game takes place like 20 years later when they built suits to head into the dark side and start looking for cool stuff. That's kind of the story behind it. And the actual gameplay, it's a strategy game where the majority of the playfield is dark, so you can't see the enemy, but unless you sort of bump into them. But there's light sources, and the game is about sort of controlling light sources and hiding your units by trying to suss out where the enemy is. And if they're in light, you're at an advantage, and if you're in light, you're at a disadvantage.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it until you said bullet hell just then, but something that is unusual about it is that the units can fire without a target, and they often did fire without specifically aiming at an enemy, because if you click on something that you can't walk to and isn't an enemy, they'll just fire in that direction.
Yeah.
And so you can create like a stream of bullets that are, I guess you can use for area.
And the bullets are actual projectiles that travel that have individual hit points, so you can actually dodge bullets. So it's not kind of like the StarCraft thing where you have a whole bunch of units and they sort of automatically just magically deal damage to things next to them. You have actual projectiles that you can move away from. So if you're sufficiently good, you're supposed to be able to like really avoid getting any damage at all.
Chris and I just played, and we did end up having a semi-micro battle because one of the units is a shield unit that reflects all bullets from the front. So it's like totally invincible unless you get it from the back. And in one of our games, we both, I think, noticed that unit was pretty good. So my next game, I'm like, right, that's all I'm building. I'm just like, you put all your, like, peon guys into one battery thing and then
turn them all into
shields. And I had this army of shields, and I marched out with my army of shields. And the first time Chris's army went into the light, it was also all shields.
Yeah, I had exactly the same thought two rooms away, deciding.
That's why you do playtesting, to figure these things out.
But then when shields fight shields, because they're both invincible from the front, they just bounce off each other, so then you have to kind of try and micro round the back of the other person while they're trying to do it to you, so you can chase each other's tails.
Or in my case, just to like mow back and forth across your line of dudes until everyone was dead, like kind of like trying to...
One guy with a gun there would have been like king. Like just picked off everyone that wasn't turned towards him.
It was also, because it's very, so like, it's life or death micro, like if you're doing the right thing and the enemy isn't doing the right thing, then you automatically completely win, take no damage whatsoever. And so, because we had a lot of these units and they're all over the map, it was who noticed the fight first, because the fights go on forever until you notice them.
Yeah, and you don't see units until you bump into them or they're in flight. Yeah. So
like, I switched to one and I found two just in the back quarter, like, alley of the map, just bumping into each other, one of mine and one of Chris's. And just as I was about to click on mine, Chris obviously spotted it too and moved his round and killed it.
Yeah, there is something sort of, I think, like, there's something inelegant about that solution to the strategic problem of the game, and it's sort of funny that we both sort of saw all the strategic options of using the snipers and the marines and the other ones, and you know, the kind of the more, like, I guess, strategically broad units that can be sort of area denial or to kind of, like, you know, scout or to pin down areas or whatever. We just both went for, like, you know what, I'm going to make I'm going to make battering rams, and then battering ram their battering rams until he has no more battering rams. But yeah, I think it'd be interesting to unpick the, what people do when people find the counter to that and don't necessarily always do it first. It feels like maybe that would be the strat that people would just do against new players, because...
Yeah.
Yeah.
It'd probably win.
I could probably figure out some good counter to it that would sort of make it less of a good idea.
Maybe make it so that the sniper EMP thing stops them?
Yeah. I thought just that. So.
Huh. Oh, weird.
Yeah.
Okay.
So how far along is the game then?
It's fairly far along when it comes to a lot of core technology stuff, and gameplay. I need a lot more gameplay testing, because any kind of competitive game like this where people are actively trying to break the game, you really need people to work on it and go nuts. But, and also it's a very ugly game, and that's why it's brilliant for podcasting. It's just like, this is how you bring it out.
You got graphics for radio.
Yeah. So,
that art style, you are going for like a schematic, abstracted look, are you?
Yeah, I mean, for now. At some point, actually, it's kind of interesting. I designed the entire game to be completely separated from all the graphics.
Huh.
So I've actually had the idea of making two completely separate graphics engines for it. So you could make like a super low end, because right now you can run it on anything. So you would have that one, and you could run it on your like netbook or whatever, and then you could come home to your super PC and just flip a switch and get like awesome mode. So that's actually something I considered, but I don't think any of that matters until it's a fun game. So it's going to be an ugly game until it's a fun game. And when it's a fun game, we can talk about making it a pretty game.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I think it looks nice in its current state. Like, just aesthetically, it's just very clean and very stark, obviously. It's very black and white.
Yeah,
it's being a game about black and white.
Yeah.
I liked your suggestion that you made earlier about possibly making it so the dark areas are schematic-sized.
That's
even something you can verb.
I think it's blueprintified.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And then having the areas of light actually rendered out in some way.
Yeah.
But,
I mean,
a bit like Monaco, but hopefully not as garish and distracting as that.
Yeah, well, the game doesn't use field of view the same way, so you don't get that sort of... The Monica has that thing, if you move a single unit, the whole playfield flickers and changes. And you don't have that, so that sort of helps. It's more like somebody threw a flare over here, it lit up this area, and now you can sort of see that area, and the flare is going to stay for a while. So, yeah, I'm playing around with a lot of like numbers right now, just how fast the units should be. Weirdly... they used to be slower, and then I made them faster, and the game became more mellow, actually, to play. It became less stressful, because you could actually, you had the feeling you could move out of the way, like, at the last second, which you couldn't do before, so it always felt like you were behind, sort of, you were always doing the thing you should have done 2 seconds ago, and then when I actually made them faster, you could play it more calmly, which is kind of counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. So I'm playing with that. I'm probably going to make it so that building units and that kind of things, or actually you're not building units, you're converting units, is going to be slower, because right now it's kind of just takes a few seconds. And right now there isn't too much choice in spending a lot of time converting your units or using them to sort of attack instantly. So I want to balance that. Mm. And then again, there's like, different levels will mean that people will play in different ways, so I need to, you know, figure out what the average level should look like. And
Is it primarily multiplayer focused? Because I know you've got an option for AI in that moment.
Yeah, I've written an AI because, don't develop a multiplayer-only game alone. Just as a tip to anyone out there who wants to. Yeah, it's tricky, and actually... Last night we were testing it, and what broke down the networking code, because it works really well when everything runs on the same computer. So this morning I had to do some surgery. The plan is to make it, I mean, it's kind of an esports game, that kind of game, where you're supposed to have a ridiculously high skill ceiling. Mm. It's also designed to be fun to watch. I think it's going to be a good sort of spectator game, because as a spectator, you can see the trap and you can see the guy falling into the trap and you can sort of, I think it has a really good potential there, but at the same time, you need some AI and some stuff so that just you can practice and so that, you know. And actually, I've heard some numbers from people, you know, and if you actually look at real, like, the big strategy games, when people play multiplayer, they usually don't play one-on-one. They play team against the AI. Mm. That's actually the most common. I think it was Age of Empires that said, like, over 80% of the online play was against the AI.
That's interesting.
That's not how we perceive that world to be, but that's actually how people...
I think probably everyone thinks that they play comp stops or whatever and that no one else does.
Yeah.
And everyone else is a scary competitive gamer and that you are just sort of sitting alone or with like one other person. Yeah, weird.
My reasoning is I like to, like, instead of winning like 50% of the time, I like to win 100% of the time. And we can only really engineer that if the enemy is an AI.
Yeah, we're working on the AI, and one of the features that I really wanted from playing StarCraft and other things is, like, I want two different sliders for the AI. One which is how smart they are and how much, like, they know about the game and how many tricks they use. And the other one is just how fast they are in sort of APM terms.
Oh, yeah.
So that you can make that, you know, really challenging, intelligent AI, but that, like, sucks at pressing buttons. So you don't have to be, like, a ninja that bit just because you like the strategy part. So. Yeah, and then obviously you can do it the other way around. If you're a dumb but fast person, you want that challenge.
I'm a fast idiot, and
I'm not afraid to admit it to an AI.
Yeah.
Probably less common than the other thing.
Yeah, my guess. But...
It's got a level editor, which is fucking astonishing the way it works.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it should be because I spent freaking forever building it. It's like,
yeah, I want you to export it so I can just use it as a vector drawing program. it's pretty poopy.
Yeah, the idea is that you can build levels and you can upload them to the server and other people can vote on them and then I release... The idea is to release one new level of it every day from the voted levels into the sort of pool of real levels. Because I don't like the idea of just giving you a million shitty levels and then say, here, look, isn't it great? I want some sort of curation a little bit. So.
It's not the best back-of-the-box feature, really.
Yeah.
Like, a billion shit.
Yeah.
Levels designed by idiots.
Yeah.
Fast idiots.
Yeah, it would be, actually, you know, if you got onto the box in time for the game's release.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's coming along.
Yeah.
When can people play?
Not now, when you're listening to this, but in a couple of days, because... as you might have guessed, I'm in the UK, and I don't live in the UK, and we've made a whole bunch of changes to the game, so I need to go home and set up my server to actually reflect all those changes so that people can play it. But the plan is to post a link to the game and put a forum thread on it.
Yeah.
And the reason I'm doing this is because I want people's feedback. I want people to tear it apart. I want... long ramblings about why it sucks so that I can fix it.
I think our forums can sort you out.
Thank you very much. So I need testers and I don't know where the game is going to go because right now it's all about figuring it out, like getting people to play it. And if it might go horribly wrong and I'll just abandon everything or it might get good. Or not, you know, you never know. So it's all about figuring that out.
Yeah.
I think what we'll do is I'll create a sub-forum in the games discussion forum for it, and then you can find, like, download instructions there when they're ready.
Yep.
And also people can post whatever threads they like for organizing stuff.
Oh, man, I just realized there was a brilliant segue into introducing a game. I should have said, Eskil, do you believe in life after love?
Anyway.
You ruined this show.
Like, you can't do a segue at the end...
You can't re-segue.
You can't segue back in, like.
I'll cut it back in, don't worry, it'll be seamless.
Oh, okay. It's like you walk in and you trip over and you're like, I was going to come back in there and pretend I didn't.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, we'll do a forum thread. And the forum.
So that's how it works, the show. Like, Marsh has never, ever said anything good during the show.
No, no, it's just
we splice it
in afterwards. He needs, like, days to think of it. The shit eats us.
Honestly, yeah. It's amazing. Like, often we record him, like, 2 to 3 weeks in advance. It's a lengthy editing process that goes into producing everything he says.
I just make fart noises in my mouth somehow through the magic of audio engineering.
Okay.
We use a lot of vocoder stuff and, you know.
Do you have a lot of writers that, you know, like a writing staff that
write
on your...
There's a whole team.
Don't open the cupboard downstairs because it is full of children right now. <Yeah. laughs> Anyway, what I was going to say was that forum people keep mentioning is at creatingcrowbar.com/forum, which might not be obvious to somebody.
What have you been playing, Chris?
I have been playing the first 3 hours of Divinity Original Sin, which is a new game from Larian, which is the company that made the other Divinity games, which I haven't played any of them, but one of them is called Divine Divinity, which is the stupidest name for a game may have ever been, one of them is called Divinity Dragon Commander, which was mad and looked pretty sexist.
I think the other one, that sounded like it could have real pull in the Christian market.
It
really felt like...
Well, Divine Divinity, move
it to a different aisle at, like...
I think if it was called, like, Divine Divinity, like, Jesus Double Dash, then you've got, like, a full Nintendo game title, but, like... Divinity Original Sin, which I quite like so far, actually, is a, like, traditional isometric RPG that, it's not a dungeon crawler. It's an RPG in the Baldur's Gate mold, and more specifically in the Dungeons & Dragons mold, because all of its systems are designed to give you a experience that is a bit like playing with a GM while you're on your own with a computer, which was the inspiring impulse behind the CRPG in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. That was why people were trying to make digital versions of, or automated versions of a Dungeons & Dragons campaign. And it's very much like that, like, to the extent that, you know, everybody you see, you can talk to. Everybody you see, you can barter with. And you can open a shop window. So there aren't, like, NPCs that are shops and NPCs that aren't. Everybody is a shop for the things that are in their inventory. and that speaks to, like a degree of simulation, quote-unquote.
That sounds like a song lyric. Everyone is a store.
There's a degree of simulation in, like, within the context of the game that's about goblins and wizards and things that is there to allow you to do the kind of things where if you're playing a pen and paper game as we are at the moment, you know, people can just sort of suggest things to the GM and the GM can figure out a way to make it work. And so to try and do that in the digital context, they've just sort of like given you like a shit ton of options at any given time in terms of how you interact with the environment, whether you hit things, try and like lift things, move objects around the environment on pressure plates and stuff. Like,
it's got quite systemic combat, hasn't it? I played it a bit at a preview event, and I think I might be remembering wrong. I think I cast like a sort of rainstorm on a boat, maybe, and then cast a lightning spell and like electrocuted everybody because
they're
mostly civilians, I should say.
But where like
sits on the Divine Divinity Original Sin scale.
Yeah.
That is the original sin, actually. A boat full of innocent people was the original sin.
I know the bit you mean, actually. Like, so this is an example of how the magic system works, for example. You arrive into the first town in the game, and you hear someone shouting, like, the fire in the harbour, someone come and help. And you go to the harbour, and if you happen to have a rain spell or a water spell, you can then use that to put the fire out dynamically. And then no one comes up to you and gives you a quest reward, it's just people like you more then. And, like, it's handled relatively dynamically. The amount of status effects is kind of crazy. Other games would have like, you know, stunned, poisoned, burning, whatever. This game has like warm, cold, damp. Like, and that affects, that has modifiers. Someone who's warm is more likely to catch fire if you keep applying fire. And so that stuff's...
Don't drink too much coffee in this game.
Kind of neat. There's an amazing...
Before you meet someone with a flamethrower, like...
There's an amazing perk you can pick up at, like, character creation or like, when you level up that I'm sure people have talked about already, but it's called Pet Pal. And it allows you to talk to animals. It allows that character to just talk to animals as if they were their NPCs. And this applies to every animal in the game. So if you can, like, chase a rat in a dungeon and click on it, it'll turn around and be like, hello!
Yeah, what?
And they've done voice recording for the animals, but...
Does that turn them into a store?
Yeah. Yes, actually. They don't have any things, though. So like, basically, like, the, most of
animals
the,
are pretty bad at stores.
Yeah, yeah. Most of the and like, the voice acting is almost always, like, it's not, like, full voice acting, it's just, like, you know, greeting and like, hello and goodbye lines. So you can talk to almost every animal in the game, and that makes finding an animal when you have that perk, like a thrill, like, because you're getting something secret that no one else gets. Like, you walk past, like, there's two bulls, and, like, hitched to a cart in the town centre. One of them's called Bill, and one of them's called Bull. And you talk to them, and, like, and all the animals are quite proper. And so you go and, like, talk to, and, you know, normally if you right-click on it as a regular character, it's like, moo. And then if you right-click on it, it's like, hello. And then he like, tells you about himself, and then you can ask about themselves, and ask about the town, and ask about what they do for a living. And then he's like, you should talk to my friend, he's a fortune-telling bull. And you talk to that bull, and he reads your fortune for some reason. Like, it's a bit mad. But it also then opens up, like, quest things. So there's, The first quest is like a murder mystery, and you've got to find out who's murdered this guy, and you hear repeated references to the guy's dog, and you can actually find the guy's dog waiting by his grave, and if you happen to have this perk, you can talk to his dog. And you can talk to his dog, and like the game is, it is dramatically overwritten, just in terms of its like sort of tone and stuff, but it's actually quite well written, which is not a bad easy balance to strike. Like, it has a real playful, like, whoever wrote it, or the team of people wrote it, have a real way of, like, turning a phrase or kind of, like, having fun with the language in a way that is a bit ebullient and kind of spills over itself sometimes, but it is actually quite a well-written game. And the dog is amazingly well-written. Because he keeps keeps talking about his former master, but every time he mentions his former master, he also has to remind you that his master was awesome, because that is obviously how a dog would see it. So it'd be like, well, my master, who was awesome, incidentally. I don't think he's dead. I don't think he's dead. But he was awesome. And, like, it's just kind of like the repeated little ticks and things. It's really nice and kind of... The dog eventually becomes an extra quest asset if you can talk to the dog. Because then you can bring evidence to the dog and ask the dog if it smells like its master. But then the thing is... The dog is in the graveyard, and if you get a spade, you can start digging the graves up, and you can read the gravestones, and then what happens when you dig the graves up is based on what's on the gravestone. And that's used to gather evidence in one particular context, but in another... It's like, you could just say, oh shit, this is a zombie now. And I got in a fight with a zombie, and all the friendly NPCs in the area ran in. Combat is turn-based. But it sort of, like, happens in a world that's designed to be roamed normally. So it's kind of weird. It's a bit like, you're forced to play Baldur's Gate in the style of the person who pauses between everything they do. And that's how the game works, if that makes sense. And in that fight, the zombie killed the dog, and it killed the dog, because the dog came to help, and it killed the dog, and like, splatter of blood everywhere, and the dog got like, and fell over, and I was heartbroken, I loaded a save. But, in that vein, key NPCs can die, like, you can break things, and you can kill people in town, and it is designed in that way to say that, like, you can see the logic where it's like, if someone was doing this as a pen and paper campaign, and the guy's like, well, I've got the talking to animals ability, so I'm gonna actually track down this guy's dog and talk to it, and the GM would then have to panic and pull something together to, figure out how that's going to work. The game was already...
They had to panic in advance. for like 5 years.
They've panicked for 5 years and made it all kind of work. And so the thing I haven't mentioned is that you're not one character, you're two characters. Which is kind of nuts. So a character creation, you create two people, and you have full reign over what they're called, who they are, what classes they are. It is like character creation in any other game. Characters are kind of spectacularly ugly. Not from a like a graphics fidelity point of view, it's kind of a cartoony game. But from a kind of design point of view, like, the men look like they've got tiny heads on these colossal bodies, and the sort of women are sort of generically curvy or whatever. My two characters are Chris and Marty.
Tiny heads on gigantic bodies.
It looks like massive hench lumberjack parallel dimension versions of the service. Or, like, what would happen if either of us picked up a mushroom from Super Mario? like, we're currently the small one health version of ourselves. Yeah. Like, boop, boop, boop. And then, like... It's terrifying, but
this is a great like bodybuilding act. Don't go through life as the one health version of yourself.
Yeah,
where the head is like half of your size.
Yeah. But Marsh's a cleric and I'm a wizard because there's a class called wizard, so I'm just going to pick that. And the way that works is normally it's a bit like you pick the first two members of your party because you get other members of your party as you go. They're both designed to be lead characters. The game can be played in co-op where you each bring two characters as well. But then when you get into moral decisions, you pick for both characters. So an early example would be you catch a man about to steal a fish from a cart, and you first pick how the character that you're currently selecting feels about it. So, like, don't do that or do that. And then you pick how the other character feels about it, and it just says, the tooltip is just like, feel free to roleplay. Like, it doesn't tell you, like, this is for a game reason. It's just like, do this.
Huh.
And so, like, occasionally we agree on things, Marsh, but I've roleplayed it so that I'm usually, because you pick a voice for characters, and I sound like the campest wizard anyway. Like, oh, a locked door, what a thrill. And, like, and whereas you're like sort of like a weary warrior kind of thing. And
quite right.
And we walk around, and you tend to pick the options that betray the least faith in humanity, whereas I'm kind of more like flamboyantly optimistic about what people might be trying to do. So, like, in the case of the man trying to steal the fish, it was like, oh, just let him have the fish. He's hungry, and I would do the same for you. And you're like, that's not ours to give away. That shopkeeper's got to eat as well. World's hard to deal with it. And then if you decide that your characters do disagree with each other, especially on a moral choice, has an effect on the game, which could be like whether you kill some guards or not early on. You then play rock, paper, scissors against yourself. I think in co-op this is done to mitigate differences between what the co-op players want to do.
Right, okay.
You can skip it if you want and just pick a winner.
That's how all great fights are solved.
But there's this amazing moment of, like, you can imagine the two adventurers kind of, like, turning away from the shopkeeper they've got to make a choice about. We had this in the Numenera campaign where it's kind of like, how are you guys just conferring this much? And, oh, God.
The second... It's about to fall down.
Yeah. Oh, God. Our cladding is... Our soundproof cladding is currently about to fall on Tom. Anyway.
You'll hear it when it happens.
It's going. You can imagine, like, the two adventurers turning away from the shopkeeper or whatever and going, like, one, two, three, scissors, shit! And then, like, going on the rest of their day, having now chosen to report the guy to the guards or whatever.
There it goes.
All
right, we'll have a soundproof floor now.
So, yeah, I mean, so the two characters think, like...
Do you think there'll be some people who play it where... They come up to the guy who stole the fish and they think, oh, what do I think about this? Okay, I think it's bad, it's wrong. And then they're asked what the other character thinks and they think, well, I still think it's bad, it's wrong. So just don't even consider the possibility of I still think this.
Whenever you get the kind of...
I agree with myself.
When you get the response thing, you get three categories of response that are disagreeing, like counter-arguments that can be intimidating, charming, or whatever. And then you get the bottom one, which is like, no, I just agree.
Right.
Like, I just agree with you. So, like, fair enough. So you can sort of opt out of it. And then after those engagements, one of the things it does get you in a game is you count against points. I don't know where this is recorded on, like, a million different, like, social categories, I guess. So, an early one was I found right at the beginning of the game, we found a corpse of a man. And the man, there was a journal that said that he'd talked to some magic statues and the statues had told him that he could fly because they'd blessed him. But he only had to jump off a cliff, and he found his body, obviously, because he's fallen to his death. And I was collecting Marsh at the time, and Marsh was like, what a moron. Like, listening to a statue, just, you know, like, he deserved everything he got. And then I responded as me, saying, yes, but, you know, there's a lot of wonder in the world, isn't there? And then afterwards, like, above both of our heads, like, I said, like, plus one pragmatic over Marsh, and plus one romantic over me. I don't know what that means in game terms, like... Its biggest problem, like, it looks quite nice, apart from the character design, actually. The environment art's really nice. But its biggest problem is that, like, I actually started it again. I started it and then played the first hour and then rebooted it because I'd understood so little I wasn't having fun. Like, there's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of systems and there's almost no tutorial. There is, like, a tutorial dungeon, but the tutorial dungeon is even then for stuff that it was kind of, like, a level ahead of where I was comfortable with, like, what the fuck was happening. It's like, move boxes onto pressure switches and these kinds of puzzles and level up your perception skill to find hidden switches and, have you considered that fire ignites poison? So if there's a poison cloud, you can cast a fire spell on it and that ignites the poison and all those, like, elements. And I was like, no, how do I access my inventory?
But I think that's, like, to me, it's a typical problem of people trying to make sort of dynamic stories. They say, oh, if we just simulate everything, we'll make it super deep, and then real stories will happen. And in reality, that's just completely the wrong way to go about it, because in order to get suspense, you need to know the options. Like, you need to know that either the world gets destroyed by this thing or it doesn't. I save the princess or don't save the princess. And that you have to actually, as a player, know what you're supposed to do the right thing. And if it's sort of, it's just, I'll do random things and then, you know, the complexity of the world will show me some complex answer. That's not what we want. Mm-hmm. We want, like, the suspense in the story comes out of how to deal with a known system, not with exploring the system.
I agree. I think the game maybe has slightly different objectives.
Then, on the other hand, I could, you know, agree that sometimes exploring a system is fun, but that's not how you build a story.
I think as soon as I understood what the game was trying to do, because it doesn't really, like, introduce itself very well, but, like, it's got, you know, it's also a tool set. It's also got mods, you know, listed on the main menu. Like, you can activate campaigns and switch things in and out and whatever. It's kind of, it is designed to be a kind of digital pen and paper game, right? Like, and therefore they've had to kind of stretch the complexity to a certain extent because, yeah, like, if you approach the poison cloud, you don't want the solution to the poison cloud to be a switch on the wall that switches off the poison cloud. You want the freedom to try using your fireball on it, so they've had to build the elemental interaction system that means that that has some kind of output.
But that's it's kind of, if you play a pen and paper, real pen and paper, you still want the dice and the rules.
Mm.
You don't want a dungeon master to just make stuff up, because then it's like, well, he can just make up whatever, right?
Yeah,
when you, it's the typical problem if you have a dungeon, there's two doors. Which one are you going to open? And the dungeon master asks you, there's like a treasure behind one of them and there's a monster behind the other one. It doesn't matter which answer the players give, because the dungeon master can say, oh, you got the treasure.
Mm.
No matter which, you know, it's still up to the dungeon master then.
Yeah, or the dice roll.
Or the dice rolls. Mm. But in the dice roll, then it's understandable at least.
Mm.
Right? Then you, as a player, you get the feeling like, okay, I took a chance, I have this amount of, you know, you can make an educated guess. It's not like some random dude I know just made up an answer to, you know, that has nothing to do with how I thought of the world because it's in his.
Yeah, well, it has no, you lose any kind of dramatic significance when anything can happen, right?
Yeah.
So that's the problem with Lost, for example.
You don't care anymore.
And any other kind of form of storytelling where the artifice behind it becomes very apparent.
Yeah, that's why, you know, when I think about these things, I look a lot on sports, which has very limited outcomes. You know, there's two teams, one's gonna win, or you could have a draw. That's all the outcomes you have on football, and quite a lot of people think that's an interesting thing to watch, and that it creates quite a lot of drama, and you know.
So what you're saying is RPG should be more like football.
yeah. Before you make a complex game, you should understand why something as simple as football creates so much drama. And understand that it's not the complexity that's going to bring you drama, it's something else. Then you can make something more complex and more interesting than football. But if you think that the solution is complexity, that's why I'm like super worried about games like, No Man's
Sky.
No Man's Sky, which like looks awesome, but it's like, I know that that's a big quagmire of like game design to make a massive world where you can go anywhere and do anything. It's like a game is about select choices where you have, you know, real choices between doing A or B or C or whatever.
I think it's going to be interesting with No Man's Sky because I think they sort of talked enough about it now that we all keep asking, like, what is the actual game? What do you actually do in it? And the answer is gone from being completely vague to being a bit more specific, and it's basically you find some resources and you upgrade your ship and then you get a bit further because now your ship can go further and then eventually you get to the center of the galaxy. And it's one of those things where, like, if it was as completely, totally open and do anything and it has no objective and was totally, like this ridiculous, overly complex dream game that I think people kind of imagine it is and want it to be, so it can be whatever they want it to be.
Yeah.
And then,
it's the same problem with Star Citizen and lots of other sort of super ambitious game. I mean,
but I also worry
going back
when
to
it comes
Spore,
out.
You know, everybody dreamed that Spore was their dream of what all games should be.
Yeah.
And, you know, it turns out, like, no.
It's like, I think when No Man's Sky comes out and it is that, there are a bunch of people really disappointed because they're like, oh, it's just, you find some fuel, you find some upgrades, and then you get to the next planet, and that's all there is to it. I thought it was going to be like a expanding empires and taking over the universe with, like, whatever I thought it was going to be. There are loads of other indie games, actually, that are, like, similarly ambitious in scope, but don't come across as being, as, you know, totally world-changing because they don't look as good. They just look like indie games. And I keep finding, like, space games in particular where it's like, oh, it simulates ships in this really rich and interesting way. And I'm like, oh, awesome. And then, and also, it simulates this in this really rich and interesting way. And also, you can set up, like, a mining colony. And also, there's empires. And then also, like, you have, it's multiplayer. And has no objective. And then, the more I learn about it, and the more you can do in it, the less excited I get. Because I start to realize, there is nothing in this game. It's actually, like, I mean, there's masses in this game, but I don't know what it is. And I don't know what, like, one example of a thing I might do in it that would be fun.
Space combat, somebody has to figure that out. Mm. Like, do a 3D space combat game that really works, because all combat is about terrain, and when you don't have terrain, it's ridiculously hard to make anything interesting, because you can always just turn around and turn towards the person you want to shoot and shoot, because there's no cover, there's no sneaking up, it's like, it's very hard. I mean, and if you look back at games like Homeworld, we all sort of idolize it because the music was so great and the sort of feel of the world was awesome. But if you look at it as an actual strategy game, it's not that great. And
actually, I really liked Homeworld, actually, but fair enough.
I really liked it as an experience kind of thing. Like,
I used to play it multiplayer. It's a lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. They actually, when they made Homeworld 2, they made something called Dust Wars, which was their concept for Homeworld 2, and they were supposed to be basically fighting in, like, asteroid fields, and when, you know, with big, like, broken down ships you could fly around, and, you know, a full sort of 3D environment. But pathfinding turned out to be ridiculously hard, because there's, like, it's pathfinding in 3D space around and over and whatever, and it became really hard also to do controls, because it's hard to click, like, I want to go behind this object in this little crevice, and, you know, the whole thing is super 3D, so it's very hard to make useful controls where you can see what you want to see. It's also hard to, like, click in the environment, because there's no surface to click on, and there's all these problems. So at some point, Sierra just told them, you just make Homeworld 2. Just, you know, make the graphics a little prettier, and that's enough.
What's the space combat like in Divine Divinity? Divinity original sense.
I haven't got there yet. I imagine it'll be deeply simulated, and you'll be able to talk to the space animals.
That, the pet perk, makes me think, well, of course you have to get that now.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Like, you'd be missing out on so
it's
much.
It's mandatory, like, one of your two characters has to have it, like.
But it's a funny thing, because I'm sure I will, if I do play this game, I think I probably will, I will get that perk. And I will enjoy talking to the animals. And I think I'll enjoy it extra because I know I didn't have to get that perk. And yet, if they publicize it well enough, everyone knows what an amazing thing this is. Everyone will get it. And there won't even be a meaningful choice in that sense. It'll just be like,
unless there's other
awesome
perks that are just as good.
Yeah, if they're all that good, then great.
there aren't any that, like, unlock stuff. Because I was scanning the list, like, trying to find, like, what else unlocks stuff that I might not otherwise see. And then there aren't really any, like, there are other perks that affect your social stuff, but it's like, you know, gradations of, you know, positive or negative. Like, your character can be in... there goes more cladding. Your character can be a know-it-all, which means that they get bonus to, like, intelligence, but people like them less. Or your character can be smelly, which means that they are negative to people liking them, but they are less likely to get targeted in combat by anyone.
Where does that give? He does stink.
Yeah. So there's
still enough going on in his life.
That's... I was really trying to find a bright side on that.
On the bright side, that orc doesn't want to hit you because you smell.
It's that bad.
Yeah. But yeah, no, there's no so comparable thing. So it's kind of mandatory to have one of your two characters be able to talk to animals, because it is way more fun. But then it's weird, just because it was a choice, every time you find an animal, like chasing rats around to try and talk to them, because you know that there's something been written for that rat that will say, like... Like, just something weird.
What has been written for you, rat? What has been written?
Do they have any explanation why they haven't formed a society?
Well, hopefully you can ask them.
Do the cows feel about being beasts of burden?
I don't know. They're all sort of, like, blithely accepting of their role. Like, I mean, but sometimes it just unlocks quests. Like, I'm currently trying to set up a cat from a pub, but the mayor's cat. Because I just went to talk to a cat, and it was like, what up? I really fancy this cat from down the road. Can you help, Band of Adventurers? And they're like, yeah, all right.
Silla Black of cats.
Yeah, indeed.
I feel like the new work in this perk have maybe got a little bit distracted. Yeah. Might become just sort of animal management sim.
Yeah. It's going to be when you get to the end of the game and the villain turns out to be a Labrador or something. and only this one guy can talk to him, or else you have to kill him.
Yeah. That would be great if like you have the perk that you can talk down the
dragon or whatever.
Yeah, it's like
oh, sorry.
Yeah, he's like, oh, I now understand the faults
this
in my ways.
Misunderstanding.
Yeah.
Oh, you attacked the village by accident.
Yeah.
What you been playing, Tom?
I've been playing Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons.
I really liked that when I played it.
It's great. It's the fucking title. Like, it's an awesome game, and I'm going to talk about why it's awesome. But it's weird that even in a game that is largely non-violent and is essentially about families and relationships and stuff, it's still so totally male-dominated. Like, the title is Brothers, and then they go with the extra mile and say, A Tale of Two Sons. It's two sons. There are no women. It's definitely not women.
Do it.
Brothers. Two men who are children, and they're brothers, and they're sons. Just to make sure there's no illusions. And there's, like, only one thing.
They need a bro edition. Just to sort of nail it. Yeah. Just to sort of the final.
It's kind of a shame because I think it would work slightly better if one of them was a sister, just for various like narrative reasons that sort of mostly superficial, but just it would just be nice if any of the women in it were not hostages, evil or dead. It is, I should say, by no means a particularly bad offender amongst video games. It's just weird because everything else about
it is
so refreshing.
Does that mean anything?
Everything else about it is so refreshing, but you kind of expect it to do that well as well, mm-hmm. and it doesn't. And there's a really disappointing way something works out later on with that I obviously won't go into plot reasons, but so it's a, we've talked about it before, but it's a kind of top-down-ish adventure game where you control two brothers, one with each thumbstick, and you pretty much have to use a gamepad. I don't know what the keyboard option is, but for many reasons, as you warned me, Marsh, it would not work without the gamepad. And you said something about, like, that it was clearly designed for a gamepad, and that it would also, if it was with a mouse and keyboard, it would be difficult to see how they would use the controls to sort of convey meaning in a certain context. I didn't know what you meant by that. And as I was playing, I was like, I don't really see what meaning this really conveys. You're just controlling two people with two thumbsticks, and it's weird, very unusual, and quite difficult sometimes. And if the one control by the left thumbstick is ever on the right-hand side, I'm fucking broken. I just can't function. I have to, like, put it down. I'm like, what the fuck is happening right now? Like, I literally can't correct it except by just memorizing that when that happens, you just push the two thumbsticks together, and that makes them change places, and then then you're on safe ground.
Yeah.
It's one of those weird, like, mental blocks. And I imagine most people don't find it easy, but I think I have a particular aversion to it. It's really kind of quaint, and very pretty, and I think it gets prettier as it goes along. At first it seems very, like, conventionally pretty, just, oh, nice little picturesque fantasy village and some sheep that you can pick up. You know, the typical thing. And then as it goes along, it gets a little bit weirder, and as it gets weirder, it kind of gets more beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And the bit with the dead giants is just astonishing visually, just like, what? Where the fuck are we now? This is amazing. And there's also, like, I was going to say it wasn't very violent game, and it isn't. But I was about to think, like, there's no real violence in it except this one boss fight. And then, oh yeah, there is that time when you get a massive crossbow and shoot it through someone's skull. But, in your defense, that person is already dead. So it's fine, you're just shooting a corpse with a crossbow. Perfectly legitimate thing to do.
It's quite bloody, that scene, where you turn up in the aftermath of a battle between giants, and they're just lying around, and their bodies, corpses bleeding away, are parts of the puzzle apparatus.
And it probably won't make much sense to just talk about it. I don't want to talk about too much about why it's so cool. When you see it, you realize, oh. So it's, for most of it, it's very slick and fluid platformer in that it's a lot of, like, unique puzzle segments where in this scene you're tied together with a rope, so one of you can swing off the other, and that mechanic will be well implemented and easy to control and stuff. It'll take you a while to get your head around it, but all the puzzles will be very, very intuitively designed, so the next thing you're asked to do is always, if it's totally new, it's very, very easy, and then the next challenge will be something you're familiar with, but a little bit harder, and to the point where I was almost speedrunning it, not because I was, like, desperate to get the end of it, or wasn't enjoying it, but just because when I know what the next challenge is and I know how to do it, I'm just like, yep, bring it on. I'm going to do that. And I think I actually missed quite a lot of content. There's something very strange with the achievements, which is I completed the game and I had one achievement out of eight, and it wasn't for completing the game. It's for a completely optional side quest. And I think every one of the achievements is something you don't have to do.
Oh, right.
And I guess I missed almost all of it. and actually, the one I got was really, for a little side quest, it was really sweet and touching and had no gameplay sort of benefit or anything. It was just a nice favor you do for somebody. That's quite, at times quite dark. And the bit you were, I finally understood what you're talking about. There's a particular moment when the controls do take on new meaning, and I won't spoil it at all, but that moment is properly fucking genius. It was so, like, it's clever, and it's a puzzle, and it's intuitive enough that you get it, and then when you get it, the moment of grasping the puzzle is also the moment of kind of understanding an emotional truth about the game.
Yeah.
It's just like everything clicks all at once, and it's just so, so brilliant.
It is good. It's also cheap. Not as cheap as it was in the Steam sale, but, you know.
Yeah.
It's like 80% off at Steam over the weekend. Fucking crazy. Giving it away.
It's cool. I recommend it. What have you guys been playing?
I've been playing Valiant Hearts, The Great War. Valiant Sharts, more like. actually, I don't hate it that much. but I just wanted to say that. Which is your fault, because you edited this podcast together out of my fart noises.
Yeah,
so you made me say this. Yeah, it's a really weird game. Like, it's one of the most kind of tonally jarring games about war I think I've ever seen. And that's including, like, all of the kind of COD, kind of, that blight of games which just, you know, think about war in the kind of the gross terms of how entertaining it is to see gouts of blood spurt out of the neck of a decapitated Nazi. And this doesn't have any Nazis in it because it's for World War One. But it makes kind of comparable levels of missteps, but in a complete different direction. It's almost like a pseudo comedy. I guess it's like a point and click game, except you don't point and click. It's a pad controlled, is how I was playing. I think maybe there are mouse controls, but it's obviously designed for gamepad. And so just a kind of 2D adventure game, essentially, where you solve puzzles and progress, you know, the cast of characters. The cast of characters is the most progressive and interesting thing about it, because actually it has characters from every possible faction. Well, not every possible faction. Several of the possible factions within World War One.
Like Protoss.
Orcs. Yeah. Orcs versus Protoss.
Yeah. But which is interesting because, it's a story you don't often hear very much in the UK, particularly because the UK being an island is often described in opposition, quite isolated opposition to the other forces within any of the conflicts that occurred in Europe in the 20th century. Whereas some of the characters are, you know, live on the border between France and Germany, and, you know, a German character has a French wife, and, you know, he gets drafted to fight for the Germans, as you might imagine, and her father gets drafted to fight for the French. And it's interesting the way they intertwine those stories, making everybody sympathetic, or at least making everybody feel quite genuine, like they are bit part players in a conflict which isn't really theirs to control, and the political agendas that they're serving aren't really necessarily theirs. And that, you know, there's obviously a level of personal tragedy that is involved in that. But it's also a game where you never kill anybody. You just knock them over the head with ladles. and there is
the forgotten tactic of World War One.
There is a dog who likes to pull levers for you. At one point, you defeat.
Yeah, I saw a lever dog in the trailer.
You defeat a boss by using your dog to play a church organ.
Dogs can't do that.
Well, they
you have spoken to them.
You've spoken to us.
Can you play a church organ?
Yeah, so it's got some tonal issues. It's got the kind of like, it's obviously inspired by, what's the name of the French giant who did Amelie, amongst other things?
Oh, Jeanette?
Yes, yeah. And it feels quite a lot like, they're looking very much at his, like the Belleville Rendezvous.
A very long engagement was.
Yes, and
World War One epic he did.
That's quite a serious film, I seem to remember, but the comparison with Amelie is particularly interesting because there's this, it has this kind of very kind of dulcet, placid voiceover over everything, narrating the story, and it reminds me exactly of the narrator in Amelie. I don't think it's coincidental. I think they've obviously...
I prefer Delicatessen myself.
Delicatessen is fucking great.
It's
is
an
great
awesome
film.
Movie.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen it, see it.
It has... this is probably not the best accolade you can give to the film. The most disgusted orgasm in a film ever.
Yes.
Didn't he go on to direct Alien 4?
Yes.
Yeah.
What a weird thing that happened in human history.
Yeah.
He directed an alien film written by Joss Whedon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Weird.
Which was terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, you were saying about the First World War.
Oh yeah, the First World War. that is about as kind of equivalent to tonal shift as it goes in the actual game itself. The puzzles aren't really up to much. They're mostly kind of bot pushing lever switch puzzles. But it's really, it really is that weirdness. I don't particularly like the caricature style they've used for the characters either, who are just kind of these, everybody looks like a, just really stumpy and beefy with these kind of meat fist hands and kind of glaring faces. And all the men look alike, and, I don't know, it doesn't, there's a really good game to be made about World War One, and what I was quite interested in the project, before I played it. On the basis that I think you could make a really interesting game which was completely narratively driven, like an adventure game about World War One, just investigating the lives of... We didn't need to have any combat in it whatsoever, but then it introduces a dog who can kill people with, church organs. So, and your main antagonist in the game is this baron who has a massive handlebar moustache, is taken to cackling maniacally and flies around in giant kind of armoured blimps and tanks and stuff. And at the same time, it's trying to deliver this kind of narrative about, wasn't it hard for the common people? And, their son is
dying. It was hard for the common people. They didn't have armoured blimps.
Yeah. It just doesn't, none of it meshes up quite right.
Which World War II game was that? Was that one of the Call of Duty before Call of Duty became whatever Call of Duty is now? There was one game where you were actually fighting as a conscript in Russia.
Big Red One.
Mm, that was good, actually.
And I remember it was like the game that actually, like, you were running, you were supposed to run in front of machine guns and you didn't have a gun, so you couldn't shoot back, and just had to do this like 10 times before you were able to pass, and it was just, it felt utterly pointless and wasteful, and I was like, this is actually really good. This is exactly what, the Second World War was like. It was not heroic and cool and with great background music. It was just a whole bunch of people who died for no frickin' reason.
And it's so sanitized in this game. And I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. Obviously, it's gauged at a quite a young level, or at least a young people could play it without being horribly traumatized. But I just don't know that that's honest enough. I think you have to give people some sense of it. And when you're going through no man's land, and there's just, people just don't fall over when they get hit by a mortar, and they don't get knocked out by ladles in the middle of no man's land very often, I can't imagine.
No.
There is one good thing that happens in Valiant Hearts, which is, well, it's not good, but one kind of bold move, where you, you're in the kind of tunnels being, tunneling below no man's land, and you encounter, a soldier from the opposite side who is in peril, and you actually help him, and then you kind of make brief friends, and he goes back to his encampment, you go back to his, and then you blow him the fuck up. But it's kind of, there's so little characterization involved in that that it doesn't really hit you that hard. Like, it's just like, oh, that character's turned into an explosion now. Bye. So it's kind of wasted, but I wish there was more of that. Like, I think it's like a, it's a good project. And I think a Ubisoft who are bold to have embarked on it at all. I just don't think it quite hits the mark. Anyway, what have you been playing? That's cool.
I haven't been playing anything. I've been playing Far Cry 3, which is not at all interesting anymore.
Oh.
Because I'm just way behind, and then I've been working. So I've been working. But I wanted to talk about a game that I want to make. Actually, that I don't want to make, but I want someone else to make it. But under my design, so that I don't have to actually work. I've been thinking about, Superman games, because if you don't know, Superman games are somewhat famous for being terrible. In fact, there's someone who said that every Superman game ever released has always been the worst game of that platform. Superman 64 is an excellent example of terrible game design. And what was there was a Superman Return.
They were all unanimously dump, I believe.
Yeah.
Although the Iron Man games did give them a good run-in for the worst games of that series.
So the problem So this is like catnip for a game designer, right? Because it's like, no one has been able to crack it. So everything is like, I gotta solve this. I gotta solve it. So I thought, what's the major problem? Well, it's obviously that Superman can just solve every problem. Like, he's so powerful. So he needs, like, a kryptonite. And what is Superman's kryptonite? And I realized...
It's actually
not kryptonite. It's Lois Lane. Right? That's the one character in the world that he has no ability to manage. And whenever he's sort of close to her, he becomes this bumbling idiot. So I wanted to make like a top-down game that is like a layout of the Daily Planet office. And you're like walking around and you have like her walking around with like a vision cone. And then there's like
Lois Lane stealth game.
Yeah. And then there's like on the side, you get like missions that sort of, there's a queue of missions. So it comes like, okay, fire at the factory or, you know, at the orphanage. And you have to, in 20 seconds, you have to go deal with it. And it takes you 3 seconds to deal with it. So then it's up to you to like get to like a window and sneak out without her noticing it and like come back. And as this sort of queue of like mining disasters and bridge collapses, you know, you have to sort of get around. And then when she gets more and more suspicious, she starts walking faster and she might ask you questions. And then there's like comes up like answers that you can sort of give for why you've been gone. And as you use them, you can't use them again. So like you get worse and worse reasons for why you've been away.
I had to go see a ghost.
Yeah, whatever. And then you would have like special abilities. Like you could like use your laser sight to like set fire to a trash can so that everybody's like occupied with that while you go, you know, save some nuns or whatever. Or maybe you have to like go over to the dark room when Jimmy Olsen is there because he's like taking a photograph of you changing clothes. So you need to like open the door so that you ruin the
murder him and dispose of the body.
So I really want to make that game. I think it would be an awesome game.
I want to make a superhero game, not necessarily Superman, but one in which you are invincible and so is your opponent. So it's like superhero versus supervillain, but you can't ever kill each other. And the only thing at stake is like supervillains are trying to, you know, make demands and stuff, and they've taken hostages. And the only thing that can go wrong is hostages can die. But if they do, then you still like complete the mission in inverted commas. In that the game carries on, and you just lost a bunch of people, and you just have to live with it. And all the combat would be based around like Gang Beast style physical, ragdolls, where you like. Because in Gang Beast, you can't actually kill each other except by environmental hazards. So, like, the punching stuff is just about wearing someone out and making it so they can't
punch them to death.
Oh, okay. Well, you wouldn't be able to in this. And no matter, even if you dropped, like, a building on them, they wouldn't actually be dead. They'd be trapped under the building until they could get off themselves. But obviously, the greater the force, the longer they would be incapacitated.
I think that was almost what Superman Return tried to do, because they had a health meter for the city and not for the actual, for Superman. So that was, you know.
Yeah, it's the right approach.
Came terrible anyway, so, yeah.
It's a good idea.
Yeah, somebody should make that. Tom? So, yeah. Another game I want to make is, I want to make, like, a Call of Duty-style game that would have, like, every weapon known to man. Like, really, like, you know, like,
start small.
Yeah, it would be, like, this, like, weapon porn factory, basically, of just, like, everything. And then you would be tasked by like taking over like a city and there would be like terrorists in the city. But you have this option of like the more cool guns you put on your squad, the more people are not gonna like you, so they're gonna attack you more and no one's gonna help you. But if you, like, take off your bulletproof vest and start engaging with people, then you can maybe sort of talk and find out who the terrorists are.
The timeless dignity of nunchucks.
And then, like, the worse you do, the more people you kill, you just create more terrorists. So it has sort of that balance of, like, trying to get people on your side. And then it's, like, gets really tricky because you, like, hire an interpreter and then, like, 5 hours later, you realize that he was actually lying all the time, and you've sent, like, 50 people to Guantanamo Bay. That was just people he, like, owed money, basically. He's just interpret wrong.
There's a good, really simple Flash game about making terrorists, where, I think it might be called Collateral Damage, and you have, your task is eliminating terrorists from some Middle Eastern village, and all you have is missiles. And missiles do splash damage, and there are loads of innocent civilians everywhere. And I think there's only one terrorist to begin with, and it's impossible to kill him without killing a bunch of civilians. And every time civilians die, any civilians who are related to them become terrorists. And so it just escalates.
Yeah, and then you would have to obviously deal with, like, home opinion or, like, politicians who come there and want, like, photo ops and...
Actually, there was a game called Joint Task Force, which was kind of like a very small-scale RTS. In which you were sort of a United Nations peacekeeping force, and you would go out to all these hostile situations and try and resolve them, but there would be, in levels, there would be TV vans, and anything you did in front of a TV van would reflect badly on you if it involved actual people dying, and particularly if it was the civilian side, obviously, it would get you terrible press, and so, like, your public opinion view was a thing you actually had to manage. It was quite cool.
Yeah, I think I would want it to be, like, a real Call of Duty. It's just a Call of Duty you would lose if you played it like Call of Duty. So I want to get all these, like, Call of Duty fans to play it. It was like, fuck, I can't beat this game. What's wrong? And then they would, like, slowly have to figure out that it's like, no, this isn't actually how you do things. This is not actually working. Mm. That would be, like, a really cool, like, teaching moment, I guess. Like,
sort of. Everything is falling off other things in this room.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Should we do questions?
Most natural.
That's the weirdest introduction to questions you've done so far. Read some questions before that lingers.
Okay. Before that gets weird.
Yeah. Mr. Juice writes, "Hello, Chris, Marsh, Graham, and Toms, and Eskel, he wasn't to know, so don't take offense by the intro. Interesting, he didn't go for a pun. In fact, actually, before we go start the questions, I was lucky to meet a bunch of people from the forums last week. Jan Yu from the forums came in to work with PC Gamer, and then I met a bunch of people, Sonata, Nemeka, Ollie, and others at ESL1 Frankfurt, which we'll talk about in a minute, the tournament. And something that came up multiple times is that the desire for a question opening pun has made it almost impossible to send questions in when people want to. So.
No more.
It's the ultimate spam filter.
It is the ultimate spam filter, but at the same time, in the aim of getting people to actually ask things they want to ask,
knock yourself out.
Just go for it. Like, we're not going to judge you for not coming up with another
pun. We will
pun.
A little bit, but we won't mention it on the podcast, so you feel okay.
Marsh
will... We'll know you privately with, like, a place about you.
Marsh will mind, but you should never be coveting his opinion.
No, I'm made up anyway. I'm just written by the other characters of this podcast. So.
Yeah, indeed. Okay. Juice writes, "A while ago, I heard someone criticize a comic in a way that completely baffled me. Don't panic, this will become games relevant later. The comic in question was the mighty enjoyable Young Avengers run written by Kieran Gillen, former PC Gamer, former RPS, former...
The Inventor of Games Journalism. The
Inventor of Games Journalism, yeah. And Killer of Games Journalism, several years later. And the complaint was that this person didn't know who he was supposed to empathize with in the story, as every main character is either gay, female, or non-Caucasian, or some mixed of the three.
That'd be sure.
It wasn't the implicit dickhead trifecta of homophobia, misogyny, and racism that really struck me. It was the fact that the complaint makes no sense. I actively seek out stories told from the perspective of people unlike myself, as it helps me understand their viewpoint. I consider any time I fail to empathize with someone else because they have different experiences to me a failing on my part, and I embrace anything that helps me fail less. As such, I get a lot out of stories told from the perspective of homosexual, for example, because I'm not homosexual, and it helps me understand things that I might never have considered before. I'm not a woman either, and I am white. Something that is often said to straight white men is that they don't understand what it's like to not be those things, which is a completely fair statement. It's made marginally less true, however, by things like the Young Avengers. Another great example of this, which you might have mentioned before on the podcast, I know someone did on a podcast I listen to any podcasts, is The West Wing. It always did a fantastic job of presenting both sides of very difficult and controversial issues in such a way that whichever side of the fence you ended up on, you understood the position of the people on the other side. So, games. While thinking about the above, I realised that there are some games that have given me similar insights. The Walking Dead gave me insight into what it would be like to be a parent, even though he isn't really, and zombies. Gone Home offered me a glimpse into what it's like to be a teenage girl. It's slightly distressing that I can only think of two examples of this sort of thing, and no, Arkham City gave me insight into what it's like to be Batman is not what I'm talking about. Are there any other games you could recommend that might give insight into people like me, whether that be because of race, gender, sexual orientation, political position, or whatever? Insight that would help empathise with people different to myself in the real world, I mean. Mr. Juice.
I'd like to recommend The Cat and the Coup, which is a game about the coup in Iran, and it's told loosely, sort of, from the perspective of the deposed leader at that time. And I suppose it's not quite what he's after, maybe, in that you wouldn't, it's not quite as other as you, othering as getting into the body of somebody who is obviously in some way different from you. That's not the kind of lesson it's teaching. But it is informing you about a piece of, world politics, which is extremely, significant, which I don't necessarily know all that much about, and in quite a kind of, personal and empathetic way. It's on Steam, free.
Okay. We've mentioned it before on the podcast, but Real Lives, again, where you just spawn a random human being on Earth, and it tells you about your economic circumstances and what options are realistically available to you in your life. It's really abstracted, and it's not like first-person perspective or anything, but just the bare facts of your life are kind of, obviously it's going to open your eyes into just how brutally difficult those circumstances are, and how, like, often, in many of the places you can spawn in the world, the almost the only option for a decent life is to leave the country and go to a different country where things are just better, even for the absolute lowest.
Yeah, it makes economic migration seem a lot more palatable.
Yeah.
But Chris Livingstone wrote a really good article about it on PC Gamer. Really surprisingly moving, I thought.
Yeah.
I think games have the ability to... I don't like the question the way it's posed, that the character is sort of trans... is that you feel empathy for the character. Because we talked about this yesterday. I feel that the idea of characters in games is kind of... the character you play doesn't matter in a game. In a piece of fiction, you have to have a good character, because if you don't care about someone in the fiction, you don't care what happens to that character, ergo you don't care about the story. So that's why, you can't be an infinite douche in a book, because people will just stop reading the book. And
that's not necessarily true, though, because there are books that are about infinite douches.
Money.
Yeah, but it's like
David Foster Wallace, Infinite Douche.
David Foster Wallace,
Hideous Men. Like,
Good point.
They have to be super compelling. Like, you can look at Tony Montana. He's like a super compelling character. He's a bad guy, or The Godfather, or you can look at Gordon Gekko. These are incredibly compelling characters that we care about, and they're cool, even though. In reality, we might not like what they're doing. They're like, we sort of want to be them. There's a reason why all the drug dealers watch Scarface. It's because it's cool. It's like, it's aspirational, right?
Really dumb, unappealing, awful characters who you will want to stick with for a long period of time.
Yeah. So that's like, if you look at books about screenwriting, they'll always talk about how to make compelling characters, characters people care about. And when you stop caring about the characters, you have no empathy. If you don't have empathy, you don't care how it ends. So that's kind of the thing that locks you into a story. But in a video game, that's already locked, because it's about you. You already care about you. No matter how shitty you are as a person, you already care. So you don't need... In Tetris, you don't need the backstory of why it's important for this guy to move the blocks around. It's it's you solving a problem, and you want to succeed because every person wants to succeed for themselves in whatever world they end up with. So I think that actually character is wrong, but on the other hand, what games are really good at is to put you in a situation and within that situation show you the opportunities you have from that situation. And as gamers, we are really interested in trying to game that situation. And therefore, games can create a situation that is, I am a poor person in a third world country. And that gives us not empathy for a person, but for a situation that other people have. We're actually sort of placing ourselves in that situation rather than sort of becoming a particular person in a third world country. So I think it's slightly different than thinking about it as empathy.
Well, to an extent, I think the flip side to that is, you know, characters still exist in games. It's still something people respond to. And they respond in a way more powerfully because their own identity is being held either in tension or in harmony with something that's been written for them by a game developer. It's particularly true of any RPG where you have some degree of control over who your character is. And you choose to make this person into you, or you choose to make them into not you, or something like that. That process still has, you know, it's the journey, not the destination, is what's important in that case. It's the fact of, if, you know, the game makes you into a character that's not who you are in real life, then you are still you, because you've not become insane, right? You're not being totally convinced you're this other person. But the fact...
But it's you role-playing,
and that's really the answer, right? That's where character remains important, or at least character writing remains important, because in some context, it's how you provide that context, you're saying. I agree that actually where the interesting tension comes from is, and where the empathy really is located with the situation in general, rather than...
And that's where we're, in my opinion, that's kind of where we role-play. Hmm. Like, if you play an RPG, you're role-playing as a different character than you are. It's escapism, but the escapism is not... I'm watching a knight, and I'm interested in what's going to happen to that knight. It's more like, I am a knight. This is how I would behave in this situation. Or this is a version of how I would like to explore this world.
But character is almost like, in games, it's more like almost like the director's notes in a way for like how something is best performed or like what it means. Like, you don't have a route to meaning if someone's not come through the first time around and sort of like laid out the necessary context to make that happen. You know what I mean? Like, you need that detail, or you can't have these social points, for example. That's what he's saying, like, it's not just about, like, games that make you feel more like Batman. Because, you know, it's not just about games that make you feel more able to execute on a particular power fantasy. It's games that actively put you in a position that teaches you something about the world. And for that, you need all that presentation layer that, from maybe a pure game design point of view, is not necessary for the core conflict of the thing.
Yeah, but I think we've all played games where the sort of, the game design forces you as a player to do something you don't want to do by sort of saying, oh, this character would do this. The character would murder this person. And that sort of breaks the illusion, but the character is me and I wouldn't do that. That's when you feel like I'm right because I'm playing me and the game is wrong for telling me. And what's much better if the game says, here's a situation, you can solve it any way you want. And this situation may sort of force you or push you towards doing something that you might not do in real life, or that, you know, you might take a difficult choice, which of course is interesting then, but it's very different from saying, oh, you don't want to do this? Well, you do, because you're this character.
Yeah, that's true.
And this character would want to do this. Mm-hmm. And that's why you sort of hate, you know, when you play a game and you're playing it in a certain way, and then comes this cutscene where the character's doing something completely out of character of the character you have chosen to play.
There are a lot of pitfalls with it, but I think it's one of the tools that you can use to have a very effective experience as well. Like, I mean, it doesn't always go right.
There's something quite subtle that the Hitman series does in giving you empathy for a character who's not at all empathetic. But not through, like, you watch him do some stuff in a cutscene and you know, feel for your story, but it's kind of seeded through, like, the art style and the situations of, or just the way that other people are depicted in that game. You're playing effectively, as far as we know, asexual, completely sociopathic outcast who has
hairless.
Really almost... He has, like, a friend in the second game, but it doesn't make any sense. Basically friendless. And doesn't understand people and sees them as basically alien. And almost all of the games are set in, obviously the missions in the first few games are set in foreign countries where nobody speaks your language. So they're all talking foreign languages all the time. So you can't understand anybody as a player. And you're playing someone who also doesn't understand people and can't empathize with them. And they are all grossly over-exaggerated in whatever stereotypical way. So the women have ridiculous, like, horrible tits. Just, like, really nasty, weird spheres that just don't make any sense. And it's not sexy at all. It's just, like, it's strange and grotesque. And they're always, in any, like, recreational situation that has men and women in it, they're constantly talking about sex. Like, every line of dialogue is just about fucking and who you want to fuck and how they're going to fuck them and why they're going to fuck them. And the men are also, like, grotesquely over-muscled to the point of, like, being unattractive. And all of them are, like, even just, like, every single human character when they... Because you take their clothes off. This is a game where you take everybody's clothes off, so you find out they're all ridiculously weirdly muscled and obsessed with sex. And so my interpretation of that is that you are asexual, and so the sexual inclinations of other people seem exaggerated to you, and you notice them more than a normal person might. And so they seems like everyone's talking about sex all the time, and they're just obsessed with it in this really gross and weird, leery way. And all of their, like, sexual characteristics are over-exaggerated and strange, and everyone feels very alien to you. And also it's a game in which you're probably going to end up killing some of these people who haven't done anything wrong. So, like, it probably doesn't help, it doesn't hurt the mechanics that they're going to, like, somehow, like, let you empathize with your character's coldness and the fact that he doesn't really care about people living or dying.
I think that game is kind of always existed in this weird world where everybody's a criminal in a way, so that it's sort of it's okay to kill everyone on the way to completing your mission, because it's all about, like, professionalism. That's kind of the goal of the world, and sort of the collateral damage is just sort of seedy underbelly of the world anyway, so who cares?
It's a game that subtly gives you empathy for a character, for a character's lack of empathy. He has no empathy, and it's all about letting you understand and fully empathise with his complete lack of empathy.
When you talk about that, it made me think of Under the Skin, that film. I haven't seen that yet.
We're seeing.
Yeah. But that's also, without giving any spoilers whatsoever, about, to some extent, coming to terms with the kind of cold appraisal of human squalor and sexual desire, and then having some sort of revelation about that. But yeah.
That's kind of the taxi driver thing of, like, going through the world and just seeing it as more and more evil and just deciding to clean up. I wanted to make that version of Batman.
Becomes taxi driver.
Yeah. I want to make a Batman movie where it's like a low budget Batman movie where Batman, he's like 65 and really, like, he's like in this mansion and he can't sleep, so he, like, goes out and goes into, like, an old car and just drives around looking for fights. And then he's, like, really, really drunk and really bad at fighting. And he's, like, just pissing off gangs and just sort of start beating them up. And he just...
Basically the beginning of Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah, and Frank Miller's already gone there before you, I think.
I want to see that movie.
Ad writes... Dear CNC Moon Wizard Factory.
Yay!
In the early 90s, I used to dream of super games. Games in which you splice one existing game world with another to form a more immersive experience. As Wolfenstein and Doom essentially gave birth to the FPS genre at this point in time, most of these dreams revolved around combining existing games with an FPS experience. I had two wishes. One was to mix the gameplay of Grand Theft Auto, which was 2D at the time, with a 3D engine like Doom's. The second was to combine the base management of UFO Enemy Unknown and integrate it with an FPS mission experience, including multiplayer, so I could visit crash sites with friends and also customize my soldiers' skills as they accumulated with experience. In my mind, it would play out much like the first half of the film Aliens. The first which came to fruition in the third GTA installment, which was a landmark game for me. The second, however, has yet to be successfully realized. My question is, do you think the second wish is ever likely to happen, given renewed interest in the XCOM IP? And secondly, are there any other super games that you're currently wishing for? P.S. Loving the podcast, ad.
Wasn't that just me?
Yeah, the XCOM Bureau Classified D something.
Yeah,
that was cool. It was XCOM the Bureau Declassified.
Okay, obvious.
Yeah.
I guess it wasn't...
The question was...
It wasn't a systemic game.
It wasn't like if you play XCOM and then the missions are actually FPS shooters. It was like a... campaign FPS with, like, more than Mass Effect or something. It was like an RPG.
We'll get somewhere like that, I think, soon.
I think it's such a cool, like, it's still a cool idea. It's one of those ideas that remains cool, which is like, did anyone remember, God, I'm going to remember the name of it. Terraforma?
That's a game.
The sort of like procedural tribes-ish open world shooter with loads of vehicles and...
Yeah, I never played it.
Yeah, I got in a bargain bin when I was like 10. That game had like, you know, sort of, you just sort of generate missions on like kind of massive open landscapes and scoot around them in vehicles and jetpacks and mechs and stuff. Sort of like a sci-fi Operation Flashpoint, but like years and years and years and years and years before that technology. And like the potential for like procedurally generated like FPS challenges with a kind of strategic, you know, turn-based strategy layer on top of that is underexplored. I would say, like, someone's gonna come around and do something really cool with that one day.
Yeah. I would agree.
Yeah.
having made one.
We were talking about your ideal Superman game earlier. I was saying, oh no, he's gonna say the game that I want to make. or have made, which is the answer to this question, which is, several years ago, I woke up from a fever dream, presumably involving cheese or something. I don't know what it caused it, but I'd fully conceptualized several games during this dream, one of which was, how to do like a City of Heroes style game, but correctly, which turns out to have, in retrospect, Dark Souls multiplayer.
Shit.
But I'd like to point out for the record, I thought of this well before Dark Souls came out, or indeed Demon's Souls. But it makes sense that you'd have, rather than have kind of a shitty MMO with, characters just milling around en masse, you would have just, this would be your city as either a supervillain or a superhero, and you would do your thing, and for a large part of it, you would be unmolested and fighting against the environment or, you know, saving people, doing the kinds of things that people do, kind of PV-generated missions. And then, as you became more successful at this, nemesis would be bussed in order to thwart your attempts and so on and so forth. I don't know quite why that hasn't been made,
yeah,
really.
this is just a list of no-brainer games.
Yeah.
Exactly. The thing about cheese dreams, when you remember, there's a like a repetitive vendor bark, like voice line in the first city in Divinity Original Sin, which I fucking love, which is a bloke, presumably who sells cheese, I haven't spoke to him, who says, "No man has more friends than the man with many cheeses." And I fucking love that line.
So true.
Indeed. I was, much as you were terrified when, Esco was talking about superhero games that he was going to mention your idea, as soon as you started talking about Dark Souls, I was terrified that you were going to steal mine. Because, like...
Is it just Dark Souls?
Yeah, so it's a game where you're in it now. So, basically, the game I want is, I want a proper, Skyrim-style sandbox fantasy game with a Dark Souls multiplayer...
Mm.
Angle tied into the kind of thrust of the plot. And I've got this entire game worked out in my head, so I'm not going to bore the podcast by filling it with it, because I think Marsh has heard it already like, twice. But,
I probably wasn't listening.
Yeah, no, it's fine. But, basically, to kind of, like, add sort of life to that, because the arc for every Elder Scrolls game ever is you are kind of wowed by its kind of magic and the potential depth of its systems and stuff at first, and then eventually you figure out how every single thing works as you mod it to death and everything else. Mm-hmm. And then you can't really ever load it again, because all you see is, like, you now see the Matrix, right? Like, you can't, there's no magic left in it.
That's all I do with my own games.
Mm.
Like, imagine playing a game against an AI that you wrote. You literally knows out, like, exactly how it thinks.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very weird.
Basically, to resist that point, to get, you know, other people in interesting ways, but to present it really nicely. Like, I think Dark Souls is... Dark Souls 2 seems better than this. I haven't played it yet, but I'm watching videos, but by having different types of invasion. But I really want... This is just sort of the high concept pitch, really. Like, I want the moment... I think the most important thing about being invaded by another player in a game like that is the moment when you're invaded, and it's the moment of realization when you realize what's happened. Like, the kind of the shift in the...
Mm, yeah.
In the context of what's happened. And obviously, like, Dark Souls presents it... Like, in Dark Souls, it's when you realize that the mist doors are all blocked up and you can't leave, and that's when, and then you get like you've been invaded message or whatever. And that's cool, but like I want the game that just has like a really, really classy way of doing it. And I think the way of doing it is to have it be like environmental. Like not just like a lighting change, but like have a bunch of things that it could be. Like, you know, in a movie, like a samurai movie or something, when people will feel the change in the atmosphere. It's like the combat approaches. Like, it's birds rising from trees. It's like clouds approaching on the horizon, something like that. Like, that's
music
what,
changing.
Like the music is even too obvious in that concept. You want the first thing that happens to be a whole bunch of birds taking off from trees in the distance, and you hear the sound. And then you think, okay, no, it's nothing. And then you see some, like thunderclouds gathering on the horizon.
You want, like, the waves and the water glass from...
Yeah, the thing.
And Jurassic Park and
then,
thing.
And then you want, like, the kind of, like, the flash of realization. You turn around and, like, there's, a player swordsman facing you.
Like, suddenly illuminated on the horizon by a flash of lightning.
that's the spawning animations.
Well, I was thinking about all this, but, like, that's the moment that, like, can you imagine if you're just doing your Skyrim questing and whatever, and you're hunting your dragons... Like, and just that moment of just completely coming from the environment, like, you could
totally have a bolt of lightning happen when you look at the person. So not when they spawn at something really subtle, and then when you see them, the actual bolt of lightning is trivial to just detect whether the player is seeing something for the first time.
Spawn
a bolt of lightning, not directly behind them, just somewhere, just so it syncs up.
But like, and have like either the sound suddenly cut out or come in, you know, just like that, oh man,
I'd like to make an MMO where that would be like insanely expensive. It would be like, several hundred pounds a month. It would be expensive. It would be like for only very
rich
people.
Rent online.
Yeah.
A lot of your ideas aren't very viable.
No, they these are the ideas that I don't make. There are reasons for it. But what I wanted to do was like have actors that would play all the parts. Right? So you would have like when you come to the shopkeeper, a dude who was like, yeah! What do you want? And you can actually talk to them over voice over IP. And it's like, yeah, it's an actor, not just reading from a script, but like...
You can persuade players to do that. Players give them points for it.
But also, there'll always be people ruining it.
Yeah, they won't stand in a shop for 24 hours.
But it would be cool to have like the luxury MMO where all the rich kids hang, and it's all like...
If only there was more economic disparity in MMO.
Literally hiring like out-of-work voice actors to be your internet butler.
That's what I want.
Great. JJ writes, "Hello, Crate and Crowbarfing Whales. Imagine a world.
There you go. That's the out of work voice actor that we need.
This summer, where esports were big enough to be on television, would people just watch reruns of their favorite matches? They air keyboard the final winning moves embarrassingly, just as people do over real sports. I would. Thanks for listening, Airy Boy.
Korea.
JJ.
That's Korea a world exists. That I live in, actually. In Sweden, Swedish state television in broadcasts.
The magical land of Sweden.
Yes.
I've heard tell of this fantasy.
Yeah. Fantasy land, yes. Well, the cool thing is that it's state television, which you thought, you always think they would be the boring ones who wouldn't do it, but yeah. And they have like a special desk, like they have, when there's World Cup, they have a special desk that says World Cup on it that they use. They have an esports desk.
Tell us about your sausage filled weekend, Chris.
So I was going to say, I wanted to answer the question. Most of the things. So I had a really interesting interview, a few weeks ago now with a guy called Paul Cholona, who's known as Red Eye in the esports community. He was the guy hosting the desk at ESL1 Frankfurt, Dota tournament this weekend. And he pointed out, because we got discussing about whether or not TV is actually the goal. Like, TV has become the lazy barometer for how big esports are. Like, if you want to ask someone, like, how big are esports? Someone goes, well, I'm on TV, it's actually a really shitty barometer. Because...
There's a lot of shit on TV.
Well, and in a generation's time, no one is even going to have a fucking TV. Like, as we understand it now, right, in terms of channels that you watch that are pre-programmed for you, right, that's going to stop existing. Because the technology doesn't require it anymore. And so, if you look at the Twitch viewer figures for most big esports, they do numbers that are either greater than, or equal to the viewer figures for most niche sports. Like, you're not hitting football numbers, but you're hitting, motorbike racing, BMX,
I would argue against that, because, all the numbers you're gonna get from TV is gonna be super regional. So,
no, I mean,
the Twitch number is going to be global.
No, but these studies have been done. The numbers are about right. Like, and that's because these things are big with kids, and kids don't watch TV.
Yeah.
In the same way, right? So, my point was going to be that, in a way, it's less about thinking about when we're going to see this stuff on TV. That's almost like a vanity position, because it's about how do I explain it to my parents. You know, how do we translate this experience to a medium that an older generation understands? But actually, what's more important is seeing it as a way into thinking about this kind of huge paradigm shift in how people consume passive media.
I think there is a point though to TV in a way, because TV, the powerful thing about TV is that everybody sees the same thing. Mm. And it's sort of the water cooler thing of like, well, TV that I don't watch, but, you know, big reality shows or Idol or those things. It's like, they become like pervasive in society, and you sort of, you can look at like, the paper will write about it. It'll have like a first page splash over what happened last night.
Another emerging medium.
Yeah, because they, well, you know, the reason why they do that is because they know that a big enough portion of their audience has seen it. It's interesting to all the people who are interested in it, and that's a big portion of the...
You can still engineer that kind of communal viewing without a broadcast television,
yeah.
I think.
I mean,
I'm not saying that you know, it's going to be TV forever. I'm just saying that TV is a weird thing, because you still have like Super Bowl and events like that that are like... you know, a big thing that spreads over into other mediums. Like, everybody talks about it and gets rewatched in other medium. And internet medium has not yet gotten to that point. There are some things you could argue are, you know, Gangnam Style maybe, but it's like, it's way more diffused. It's not the same thing as like when everybody talks about, you know, Idol last night in a whole country.
What I'm saying is that historically that's the past, and what, you know,
yeah.
the technology of TV will be replaced with the technology of computers. You know what I mean? Like, it's just going to cycle over.
Historically, that's the past.
It's good. Episode title.
Yeah, what I should have said was, like, adopting a historical perspective,
that's
the past, transitioning into what will be the future, right? Like, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
Esports definitely don't need TV.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not...
So speaking of esports, I realized I was going to talk about this earlier, and I'm not actually going to talk about wholly what you think I'm going to talk about. So I spent the weekend at a Dota 2 tournament in Germany, which was great. It was at a football stadium in Frankfurt, you know, 25,000 people cheering for Dota is an extraordinary thing to watch in any
sense. Was it full?
They sold up, I think, it seemed pretty full. It was hard because like, people moved around a lot. It was unlike a lot...
Sit still so we can count you.
Well, unlike other events I've been to, it was not wholly dedicated to the sport was the main event. But there were booths set up where people could go and do other things. The most pointed one was there was a Heroes of New Earth booth in the corner looking kind of unpopulated. And it was the saddest thing, because it was like, Heroes of New Earth could have been, should have been Dota 2, really. Like, it was Dota 2 before Dota 2. And there was kind of like, people kind of going around to try and win keyboards and things by playing it, and then like rushing away from it the moment the game started. So there was that, what I'm saying is there was an aspect of the game convention to it that kept the crowd fluid, even as people kind of, on the whole, went back to the seating banks to watch the main thing. And that was, you know, exciting and really good and really, like, interesting for me, and wrote shitload about it, which you can find PC Gamer. But, what I really want to explain is something that was actually quite important for me to learn the way I did when I was out there, which is how not to eat a sausage in a crowd. And I think, like, honestly, like...
We're getting into the deep stuff.
If I have ever shared anything with the listeners of this podcast that might one day save them, something personal, then this would probably be it. So, imagine you're going to place yourself in the scene, right? You are in the, you know, the VIP seating area of a Dota 2 tournament where available to you is free Red Bull, free beer, and free... like breakfast. So all you've eaten, consumed for like 3 days is sausages, Red Bull and beer. And, you go for a sausage. And, idly, you, fail to appreciate the water retaining properties of a Frankfurter's thin membranous skin.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And in this moment, you, I don't know, feeling a bit fancy with how you consume this particular hot dog. Bite both ends off.
Oh.
So you bite one end, and then you bite the other end. And then you flip around again. And then, at the moment when you clamp down to take the next bite of your delicious German sausage, you end up blowing sausage water all over the back of the person sat in front of you.
Yeah.
It's uncomfortable for you. It's uncomfortable for him. He doesn't realize what you've done. because the spray of sausage water is diffused enough that he probably wouldn't even necessarily be aware of it for a while. And by this point in the day's proceedings, everyone smells like sausage.
But we can only get a lot of emails from women. It's like, now you know.
Yeah. Now it's like, it's not, because the people laterally to you have seen what has happened, because they've just seen you, like, honk sausage water all over this.
Gesundheit.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not, it's not a place you want to find yourself, right? And so, I'm just going to say this, right? If you're at a Dota 2 tournament in Germany and you go to sausage, stick to the first end you pick. Pick an end and work from that end down to the other end. Or make your peace with the consequences. And that's all I've got to say.
About major ESL 1 takeaway.
Yeah. From them. Yeah. It was really good. Lots of Dota was played, into a shitload of really kind of charismatic and too cool for school 20-something Dota professionals. That was my time. Do you love random sport? I really do. Next question. And final question is from Zach. Zach writes, "Dear Games Master, what is the cheat so my ammo never runs out in future cop LAPD? Also, how do I push the truck in the water so I can have Mew underneath and open my own gym on the Game Boy?" You ever watched Game Master when you were a kid?
Yeah.
Yeah. P.S. It's nearly episode 52. What birthday extravaganza have you got planned? Will you at least be throwing tantrums, getting too excited, and spilling blue fizzy pop down your fronts? Thanks, Zach. It is. We have almost been doing this for a year, which is kind of nuts when you think about it, because that's like a whole year. Many of us have only lived several of them.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
I don't know. What are we going to do? Well, we haven't decided yet. Are we going to do something for the episode 50 or episode 52?
I think 52. But 52 gives you more time to plan.
But it doesn't make any sense, because we skipped some weeks over Christmas, yeah, so it's not literally
a year. Well, like, the date one. Like, the date one. July the 19th or something. Is,
yeah, which will probably be, like, actual episode 50.
Whatever it's called.
Oh shit, I'm going to be away.
No, episode 50 is next week.
Really?
It'll be 51, I think.
Yeah, it's the one after 49.
That's okay.
Oh yeah, thanks so much.
It's alright.
Shit, I'm going to be away then. 52.
Let's do something special next week.
Okay, we'll do something special next week.
Whenever. On a non-special date.
Whenever you think you're listening to something special, that's when they did it.
Yeah.
Maybe it was today.
Yeah, maybe next week we'll try and get all five of us on the podcast at once, and we'll do something.
Cool. It has been
a wild ride.
Zach races, has it? It's been
the wildest ride I've been on.
Sedate, slightly boozy ride.
It's been a calm sitting down. This last year. Zach raises an interesting idea for an alternative to coming up with Crate and Crowbar puns each time, which is just say something that isn't true. Because it's just isn't us.
Yeah, exactly. That works perfectly well.
I have a sort of mental disorder where I find anything that isn't true inherently funny. As long as it's like just the right level of obviously untrue. Like, obvious but like similar to what's true.
If you can't pun, lie. That's what my grandmother always used to say.
I did, I was thinking about this, and I'm going to post about it on the forums eventually, but I do want us to do something live eventually. Like, back when I was thinking about a few months ago, I thought maybe we'll do it for a year, but probably now it's going to be a bit later than that. But if there's any interest in gathering in a place to do this in for reals, then maybe let us know on the forums, because it'd be good to kind of gauge interest in that kind of thing.
You're like moving up in locations, like from Marsh House
to Marsh's other house.
Yeah.
Now with Chris.
And then
actually, we all live together. And now
it is a move up. I have to tell the podcast listeners that British houses are generally not that great. But
Thanks, man.
But I'm sorry. It's just the truth. It hurts, but it's true. But I remember I put my head on the floor in the old house. And you know, there's this little gap sometimes between the floor and the wall, and I could actually see sunlight coming in.
Oh yeah,
that's like
the graveyard flat was not.
That's not like drafty. That's like, I don't know.
Semi-levitating.
Yeah, wasn't just sunlight getting in. It was all kinds of animals.
Yeah, it was, yeah, that was. Yeah.
I do miss that place.
Mm.
All the corpses, you know. But,
corpses, the tiny beetles.
Yeah, the wood lice are like your commanders is my army.
Now you have to live with another human.
Yeah, I know. I can't tell you to form into a giant screaming face.
But it was kind of the
mass bodies.
It was kind of the perfect place.
Stop you trying.
You know, if you just take pictures of it. Yeah. Like, it was really cute. I always thought it was
bucolic, I'd say.
Yeah, and since it was in a graveyard, I always thought you would, like, pick up, like, Twilight chicks. They'd all be like, holy shit.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say the plague.
Very, very few chicks in that graveyard, I think. Or indeed the plague.
But many dead.
Many dead people.
For a very close proximity to them.
Yeah.
And that's... all of the questions
we have corpses for this week.
Indeed. If you'd like to send us a question, do you mind if I do this bit, Marge?
Go for it.
We started.
No, go on.
Only you've just realised that it's your thing.
Please finish.
Okay. Thank you.
Don't bite it off at both ends. Bite it off at one end.
If you'd like to honk sausage water all over our questions, you can honk us at questions@creightoncrowbar.com. You can honk us on the forums at creightoncrowbar.com/forum. Or you can honk us as individuals on Twitter. I'm at C Thurston, that's CTHURSTEN.
I am at Bentadact, BNTADACT.
I'm at Kelslar, QUELSOLAAR.
We'll put a link in the notes.
Yeah. Or Kelslar.com, or you can email me at eskil@obsession.se.
Many ways to honk, Eskil.
Yes.
Many ways to honk.
Because I really want you to tell me what you think about my game. So I, you know.
Yeah, true.
I need high honkability.
Yeah, when we make forum thread.
And do check out the forums for Eskil's game. Marsh.
I'm Marsh Davis. It's DAVIES. And if you want to also have something to mop up your honkage, then I can recommend a series of absorbent cloths that may also serve as t-shirts that are available from our website.
They're multi-purposes. If you're ever in a German crowd and you suddenly feel the spatter of sausage water on the back of your head...
Or indeed any other kind of viscous liquid.
And you turn around and the person behind you is wearing an attractive Gabe Newell owl or Gandalf hose t-shirt. You know, they know, that you know, and it's fine. And you don't need to fight them.
Thanks for listening. Tack för att ni lyssnade allihopa.
Yeah. Do you know any other languages?
No.
Okay.